son lived in New York and was an airline pilot. Mary Ott Joyce, their only daughter and the apple of her daddy's eye, was married and lived in Michigan. The next brother was studying medicine in California, and the two youngest boys still lived at home in New Jersey. "It's brought us all together," Bruce Ott kept telling people, but it went without saying that this was the worst experience of their lives. It came as no shock to Mary and Ott to learn that her son was fooling around with marijuana, but the old colonel was dumbfounded. The connection of his son with two crimes, marijuana and murder, was almost incomprehensible. Bruce Ott sat in the courtroom next to his wife and daughter, trying very hard to sort it out. Mary and Ott knew as a certainty that her son did not deliberately kill a Texas Ranger, and the colonel had sworn to spend his last dime if that's what it took to get an acquittal in the murder case. "I guess I'm the redneck's redneck," he said at one point, "but why did he have to be messing around with marijuana?" His daughter Mary reminded him that he was exceptionally fond of martinis. He reminded her that martinis were not illegal. The second or third day of the trial, Mary amazed herself by blurting out, "Daddy, would it shock you to know that I've been smoking marijuana for 5 years?" Only a lifetime of military bearing prevented him from crying. All he could say was, "I'm very disappointed in you." The Otts had retained the two lawyers originally appointed by the court. Hal Jackson and Al Levy were respected courtroom lawyers with good local connections. They were known as the Odd Couple. Jackson was the 58-year-old Silver Fox of Denton criminal law, a lifelong native and a highly decorated war hero. Levy was a 28-year-old boy wonder in town who had immediately tested the waters by running for district attorney. Levy had run against Jerry Cobb and Cobb's top assistant, Fred Marsh. The three of them remained good friends. Marsh and Cobb frequently kidded Levy that his one mistake was running as a Republican. Jackson was the odd part of the couple. He regarded prosecutors as worthy quarry, but damned if he would go for the throat, and damned if he would let the other fellow go for his. Whatever their differences in age and style, Jackson and Levy worked well together. Levy was glib and funny and self-effacing, while Jackson played counterpoint as the stumbling old fool, leading juries up alleys of his choice and then pouncing on them. Once the town had recovered from its initial hysteria, Levy and Jackson put their plan into action. The first order of business was to prevent future outbreaks of hysteria. The emergence of another unexpected jailhouse informant, for example, or loose talk about their client's days at Timberlawn. Several of Greg's old friends were urged to take long vacations, including Ron Mickey, who, according to a report, was threatening to bring a Dallas motorcycle gang to town and lead a jailbreak. Their defense rested on the well-founded theory that an intelligent, independent-minded jury would see the incident of February 20th as a massive police foul-up. There was reasonable doubt that Greg Ott even fired a pistol, much less at a man he knew to be a cop. There was hardly any physical evidence, and part of what the prosecution had was mutilated by the bunglings of the Denton Sheriff's Office. The state might have proved the bullet hole in the door was made with a .38, except some deputy had rammed his pencil through the hole so it would look neater. The test that could have proved that Greg Ott indeed fired a pistol that night was inconclusive because the deputies had first insisted on fingerprinting their man. Jackson had calculated that the state's weakest witness would be Agent Neal, who fired the first shot. Neal's own record was not lily white. He had been involved in other dope shootouts and had killed a suspect in an abortive dope raid in Houston. The most recent example of Neal's proclivity toward the wrong move came less than a month before the killing of Ranger Doherty. Neal awoke one morning to find not only his prize informant, but also $9,500 in state buy money missing from his home. the informant's whereabouts and how he managed to get the money out of the locked trunk of Neil's car were mysteries that still bothered the DPS. The department had suspended Neil for 5 days, which indicated they were not entirely happy with his performance. Unfortunately for the defense, Jackson was not able to get much of Neil's biography to the jury, but he still had a use for him. During direct examination, the prosecution had asked Neil to step over the schematic near the jury box and draw the trajectory of the shot he fired at the fleeing Greg Ott. When it was the defense's turn to cross-examine, Jackson asked Neil to return to the schematic and continue his line of trajectory. Cobb quickly objected, and Judge Bob Schofield, who several times seemed on the verge of having Jackson clamped in irons, just as quickly sustained the objection. But it didn't matter. Suddenly, everyone in the courtroom was drawing a mental trajectory. The bullet would have gone right through the door where Ranger Doherty was killed. When it came time for the defense to present its case, Levy and Jackson had to answer one quick and momentous question. Had the state proved its case? Although the jury had been permitted to examine a photograph of Ott taken on the night of February 20th, the one in which he looked like Charles Manson, the defendant they had seen in the courtroom was scrubbed, groomed, and attractively attired in a three-piece suit borrowed from Jackson's closet. This was the impression they hoped the jury would take with them. Levy took a straw vote among members of the press, who mostly agreed that the worst they could get was involuntary manslaughter and long probation. The lawyers weighed whether to call Jimmy Baker as a witness and decided it was a poor risk. They would have to vouch for Baker's reputation, which was hardly what their client needed at that moment, and they couldn't really be sure what Baker would say under oath. Anybody who tells two different stories has obviously lied once, Hal Jackson reasoned. The only other non-police witness was Ott himself, and they would call him only as a last resort, in the punishment phase after a verdict of capital murder. They couldn't afford to open up Ott's psychiatric record, however dated and oblique. The jury already knew that Ott was a dope dealer. If they also had to wrestle with expert testimony that he had once been diagnosed as having paranoid personality with aggressive tendencies, then, sir, it would be time to make a fist and wait for the last needle. Levy and Jackson decided to call only three witnesses, all of them law officers, who would testify that the mysterious Jimmy Baker had also been charged with capital murder. This was done merely to make the jury wonder, where the hell is Baker, and why didn't the state call him as a witness? Only an hour or so after the defense began, it rested its case. Things looked pretty good. Bruce Ott was so happy that he offered to buy martinis all around. Marion Ott protested that it would be bad luck to celebrate prematurely and led the colonel off by the arm. In retrospect, it was a wise move. Al Levy's closing statement was predictably incisive, except for one very unfortunate slip. Pointing to the door with the hole, which sat in the middle of the courtroom, Levy told the jury, "When Greg Ott fired that shot..." "Say what?" This was the first and only evidence the jury had that Ott did fire a shot. When someone asked Jerry Cobb later why he didn't pounce on Levy's slip in his own closing statement, the young district attorney said sheepishly, "I was thinking so hard what I was going to say, I didn't even hear him." Cobb's final statement was short and explosive. He described Greg Ott as a man ready to kill for his stash and demanded that Ott be convicted of capital murder and pay for his crime with his life. Later, outside the courtroom, Cobb would fight back his own tears and describe it as the hardest thing he had ever done. It took the jury about 4 hours to find Ott guilty of the lesser crime of murder. When Judge Schofield read the verdict, the only one at the defense table who didn't look slightly relieved was Greg Ott. There were tears in his eyes as he was led off in handcuffs. The jury would still have to come back in the morning and deliberate the sentence, which could range anywhere from 5 years to life. But the threat of the death penalty had ended. "It feels like a tie," Al Levy told reporters. Levy seemed as relieved in defeat as Jerry Cobb did in victory, and Bruce Ott watched in wonderment as the two lawyers shook hands. "I can't understand lawyers," the colonel said, shaking his head. "They laugh and joke with each other while my son's life is at stake." That night, as Levy, Cobb, and Fred Marsh were cooling their emotions and indulging in some serious drinking, Levy called it probably the best verdict I've ever seen. "Ott's a violent and dangerous person," Jerry Cobb said. "His whole personality proves it. If he hadn't killed the ranger, he would have probably ended up killing someone else," Levy agreed. "Where's your evidence?" I asked the lawyers. "I hadn't seen it. The psychiatric report was 10 years old and vague to the point of being irrelevant. True, Ott didn't conform to some people's standards of behavior, but not a single witness had testified to an act of aggressive behavior since that time long ago in San Antonio. I got some pictures to prove he was into S&M and bondage and all kinds of kinky sex," Cobb said. "Come to my office in the morning and I'll show you." The following morning, with a couple of Texas Rangers looking over my shoulder, I examined the material seized from Ott's home. There were photographs of whips, body harnesses, dildos, and spiked collars, the sort of stuff you'd see in any pornography shop. There were also some lesbian magazines and a book titled Sex with Dogs. "What do you think the jury would have thought if they had seen this stuff?" one of Cobb's investigators asked. The only witness called by the defense in the punishment stage of the trial was Greg's mother. She was not called as a character witness. That would have opened up those doors Levy and Jackson wanted shut, but rather to testify that her son had never been convicted of a felony. But on the grounds that she hadn't really kept up with her son for 10 years, Judge Schofield refused to allow her testimony. Greg Ott kissed his mother's hand as she walked down from the witness stand. She didn't have it in her to smile again. A few hours later, when the jury returned and sentenced Greg Ott to life in prison, Marion Ott fainted. I do not know what went through the minds of the jurors, but I think they felt obliged to pinpoint the blame for the tragedy of February 20th. Obviously, the jurors believed that Ott did not know he was shooting at a cop. Otherwise, they would have found him guilty of capital murder. But if Ott didn't know the man on the other side of the door was a cop, who did he think it was? The prosecution argued that he shot to protect his marijuana, but I don't think this is a reasonable assumption. In the few seconds of action, all Ott really had time to know was that his house was being broken into from all directions and that he was being shot at. In that situation, my guess is that he did what any other Texan inside his home with a gun in his hand would do. He fired back. Because of fate, a member of one of the legendary police agencies in the world was killed. I believe that in their honest attempt to attach blame, the jurors reduced the tragedy to a single notion: dope dealer kills Texas Ranger. No matter how they weighed the evidence, that was the crime. What lingers is not so much the crime as the tragedy. Caught up in the scent of the chase, 5 heavily armed law enforcement officers, none in uniform, surrounded an isolated house in the middle of the night, hoping to trap and arrest a man with 20 pounds of marijuana. That is their duty. But why were they pursuing it as though they had just cornered the whole French Connection? Ott was a dealer of illegal chicken feed, not an all-points bulletin fugitive. He wasn't going anywhere, except to class the next day. The crime of selling 20 pounds of marijuana to an undercover agent would probably have been worth no more than a long probation in Denton County. It wasn't the crime that obsessed the officers. It was the chase, the irresistible urge against common sense to play cops and robbers. Because of this, a Texas Ranger was killed, and a 27-year-old graduate student will spend at least the next 20 years of his life in prison. Bob Doherty should be taking his long overdue vacation right now, just as Greg Ott should be working on his master's thesis and living according to the terms of his probation. Instead, two lives are destroyed. This is the tragedy for which no blame has yet been fixed. Texas Monthly Archives. Letter from Eagle Pass. The night in question. Who killed Border Patrol agent Jose Gomez Jr. and dumped his body in an irrigation canal 30 years ago? His partner would still like to know, and so would the people who think his partner could have been involved. By Jesse Bogan. Published April 2008. On April 21, 1978, Border Patrol agents Frank Lugo and Jose Gomez Jr. drove their truck down a ranch road outside Eagle Pass and settled into their evening shift along the Rio Grande. They planned to lie in wait for illegal immigrants near a check gate in an irrigation canal. Swift and deep, the canal was the first hurdle for crossers after the river, and the gate was like a catwalk across it. Separated by about 40 feet in the darkness, agents Lugo and Gomez intended to jump the first group that walked between them. It was a sound plan, but something went wrong. Though stories vary about what exactly happened, while Lugo was chasing a group of immigrants, his partner Gomez vanished. The gauntlet of trails along that stretch is difficult to navigate during the day, let alone in the dark. Agents searched throughout the night, but the grim discovery of Gomez's corpse didn't come until mid-morning, after the irrigation canal was drained several feet. They speculated that he had probably lost his footing while pursuing the immigrants across the narrow canal gate and fallen into the water below. Yet the following week, an autopsy found that Gomez had been struck on the head three times and strangled. Suddenly, supervisors realized that the search party had trampled through a crime scene. Even more unsettling, the last person known to have seen the murder victim alive was his partner, and Lugo's story didn't add up. In South Texas, Gomez's disappearance made headlines for days, a few of them hinting that the killer could have been Lugo. It didn't help that he seemed to change his story each time he told it. He contradicted himself about the events leading up to the encounter with the immigrants, about the direction they came from and ran, and about the last place he had seen Gomez alive. But what could Lugo's motive have been? No one knew. And no one knows. The case, one of many unsolved murders on the border over the years, still gnaws at agents who knew Gomez and Lugo. They can't understand why it was never solved. Though Lugo has never been arrested or indicted in connection with Gomez's death, he was the lead suspect for a number of years in an investigation conducted by the FBI. That case ultimately went cold with no conclusion. A separate administrative investigation by the Immigration and Naturalization Service, which at the time maintained jurisdiction over the Border Patrol, sustained an allegation of inattention to duty, but not an allegation that Lugo's actions had resulted in or contributed to the death of Gomez. The INS stopped short of firing Lugo, but the incident still threw the protective bond of the badge into question. Some agents believed that he was unfairly scapegoated. Some had grave questions about his role in the crime. Lugo, for his part, denied any involvement whatsoever. In fact, the central effort of his adult life has been convincing people that he is innocent. He wrote an unpublished book titled The Exoneration. In 1982, he and his wife sued the FBI and the INS for $21 million, alleging that the investigations had put pressure on him at every turn to confess to actions and/or crimes he did not commit. The case was dismissed. If he is innocent, Lugo's life has been a second tragedy, a slow death weighed down by suffocating stress and disappointments. but is he? After 30 years, what happened is still a mystery. Lugo and Gomez both came from large Spanish-speaking families in South Texas border towns, but that's where the similarities end. Growing up in Laredo, Gomez traveled often with his parents for migrant farm work. Lugo was raised around field work too, but his father owned trucks, organized laborers, and was involved in local politics, a full contact sport in his home of Donna. The two men followed different paths into the Border Patrol. Gomez decided to join after chatting with agents while fueling their trucks when he worked at a gas station in Laredo. Lugo came in after a stint in the Army. He was drafted in 1967 and sent to Vietnam. But halfway through his one-year tour, he returned home to be near his sick father. He would finish the second half of his military obligation as a lifeguard at Fort Sam Houston. The war marked a turning point in Lugo's life. When he came home to Texas, he was nervous. His thoughts drifted, and he kept to himself, said his older brother, Roberto, who later became the first Hispanic mayor of Donna. Lugo was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. He still receives government disability payments for the condition. But he fulfilled his goal to graduate from college, earning a marketing degree in 1971 from what is now the University of Texas Pan American in Edinburgh. He landed a job in a state welfare office, married in 1973, and a few years later, on a whim, took the Border Patrol exam and passed. Gomez was placed in Eagle Pass in 1976. George Baxter, who graduated at the top of Gomez's academy class and was also sent to Eagle Pass, remembers Gomez as a prudent, quiet agent, one who took notes and drew maps of the areas he patrolled in Maverick County. Lugo cut a different figure. He was opinionated and outspoken, especially on the subject of inequalities between Anglo and Hispanic agents. But former colleagues described him as a misfit, whose lavish storytelling about war and women was part of his persona. "Most of the time, I would just tune him out," recalled Agent Joe Mendez of Dallas, a friend of Lugo's who retired in 2004. One thing, it was Vietnam, then working somewhere else. Then, about the fourth or fifth time around, he'd be back at Vietnam again with a different story, and you would be, "Frank, nobody would believe these stories you are trying to push out." Gomez and Lugo teamed together on several shifts, but they didn't get along well. In 1980, Gomez's widow told INS investigators that her husband didn't trust Lugo enough to walk in front of him. He was someone who often made bizarre comments. On one occasion, she recalled, "Lugo asked Joe what he would do if someone came behind you and tried to kill you." On the night in question, the two agents started their shift at 4 p.m. According to Lugo, a group of crossers appeared after dark. The agents nestled into their hiding spots, about 40 feet apart on a trail by the canal. At some point, Gomez, closest to the approaching group, fired a warning shot, a violation of policy. He yelled for the immigrants to stop, but four or five took off sprinting. Lugo rushed toward the ruckus, but later said that in the commotion, he could not clearly determine where Gomez was. This was one of several key details he would contradict. The immigrants split up and quickly scattered. Crossing the canal gate, Lugo searched a cane-covered strip of land that buffered the Rio Grande. He came back to the canal crossing with nothing. No immigrants, no Gomez. He eventually climbed back up to a lookout point where the truck was parked. He flashed the lights and honked the horn. He yelled out for Gomez. He fired his pistol, also violating policy, to get Gomez's attention. Nothing. Lugo did not immediately report the disappearance. He would later explain that he had assumed Gomez would turn up and didn't want to embarrass him. But finally, at 11:35 p.m., just before the end of the shift, the radios of the other agents on duty in the area began chirping. "We had some wets come over the check gate," Lugo said. Some went upriver and some went downriver. Gamez went downriver, and I haven't been able to locate him. I'm going to have to go look for him. 22 minutes later, Lugo was on the radio again, this time with a slightly different account. I went to look for him. He went upriver on the riverside of the canal, and I went downriver for some wets, and I come back and I haven't been able to find him yet. Agent Baxter, Gamez's friend from the academy, was the first to show up and scour the area. Lugo told him several different stories. First, he recounted hearing a splash in the river. Then he said the splash was in the canal, about 100 yards away. First, he claimed the immigrants had been walking from the highway side of the canal toward the check gate, which Baxter knew from experience to be unlikely, since it would have needlessly exposed them. Then Lugo said they'd been coming from the river side of the canal. As more agents arrived, Baxter observed that Lugo was telling each of them a slightly different story. Still, at that point, everybody figured Gamez was merely lost. Supervisors told Lugo not to mention that Gamez had violated agency policy by firing a warning shot. They didn't want his image to be tarnished when he reappeared. Meanwhile, as they combed through the thickets, agents detained several undocumented immigrants. Following routine procedure, they returned the immigrants immediately to Mexico. Later, Agent Ramon T. Juarez gave a sworn statement in which he declared, "I would sure like to have those 10 illegal aliens we found laid up on the river. They were scared. They knew something had happened. Lugo talked to them. I saw him talking to them." A group of 5 immigrants caught in Brackettville, 46 miles north of Eagle Pass, told authorities they had crossed the canal at the same spot around the same time, but they weren't held for questioning. Since most of the initial search was limited to areas Lugo had described, he was effectively in control of it, a fact that rankled some. Several days later, Jack L. Richardson, the deputy chief patrol agent of the Del Rio sector, concluded in a memo recapping the night, "There can be no doubt in my mind that Border Patrol agent Frank Lugo lied to me at the scene and concealed material facts from me which would have aided and assisted our officers and the Mexican officers in the conduct of this search operation." The FBI assumed command of the investigation. Lugo was stripped of his weapon and remanded to administrative duties in the Eagle Pass office, pending the outcome. When the FBI homed in on him as its prime suspect, the writing was on the wall for many of his peers. They assumed that he had been AWOL during the murder, frightened and unable to defend his partner, or an eyewitness to the hideous deed, or perhaps the murderer himself. Lugo agreed to 2 polygraph tests, both of which were inconclusive. But later in a deposition for his federal lawsuit, he said that he had taken an anti-anxiety drug before one of the tests, which can distort the results. Lugo's credibility diminished when he told the FBI that on the night of Gamez's disappearance, he had found a bag of clothing in the brush and thrown it into the canal to avoid paperwork. Finally, he was called to testify at a federal grand jury in Del Rio, where a government prosecutor tore into him. In the exoneration, Lugo recalls the prosecutor accusing him of being a liar and proclaiming that his hands and feet were lethal weapons. Lugo blamed the autopsy and the media for his woes. According to his book, he told the grand jury, "I am sick and tired of the way I have been treated. I have been considered guilty until proven innocent. Damn that autopsy. There's no way Joe could have been murdered. I wouldn't have let it happen to him or anyone. Joe Gomez forgot about safety, and now I have to pay the price." Lugo remained on administrative duty in the tiny Eagle Pass office, but he resigned after 2.5 years due to what he referred to as his mental and physical condition. Though the INS investigation had concluded that the evidence didn't prove Lugo's action had resulted in or contributed to Gamez's death, the other agents were shunning him. He was grinding his teeth down flat. He was hospitalized and medicated for depression. A few years after leaving the patrol, Lugo found a job with the post office. He spent all his spare time working to clear his name. One of his two daughters recalls that during her childhood, Lugo was always hammering away on his book. His federal lawsuit stalled, but he kept trying to get compensation, sometimes acting as his own attorney. He filed open records requests with the FBI and the INS and contacted Hollywood screenwriters, book publishers, the Commission on Civil Rights, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, then Attorney General Janet Reno, various congressmen, and the U.S. Supreme Court. Meanwhile, throughout the 80s, FBI investigators continued to work their case. They persuaded Lugo to undergo a marathon hypnotism session. They attempted to contact some of the immigrants who had been caught and released during the search for Gomez. A promising lead came in 1981 when an undocumented Mexican immigrant in the Chicago area told an informant that just a few years earlier, he had killed several people, including a guard, while crossing the border near Del Rio. The FBI made several attempts to find him, but it's not clear if he was ever questioned. Access to many case records was restricted to protect the investigation, making it difficult even now to determine what exactly investigators found. The most recent available document, dated 1987, states that agents will attempt to verify recapture of an unnamed person of interest in Reynosa, Mexico. In 1988, 10 years after Gomez was killed, the case was closed. The FBI had run out of leads. Retired FBI agent Fritz Bohn was one of several agents assigned to the case. He told me the investigation was especially difficult because there was so little physical evidence. I asked him if his colleagues at the Bureau thought Lugo had killed Gomez. It was on everybody's mind, he said. But if you can't prove it, you can't charge him with it. The agent who ran the INS investigation, James Lucas of El Paso, is more direct. Today, at 76, he still believes that Gomez was not killed at the check gate and dismisses Lugo's explanations. He knows exactly what happened, Lucas told me. I strongly believe that, because what he says happened did not happen. A persistent theory among those who have followed the case is that while Lugo was not the murderer, he might know who was, that some of his relationships were questionable. Lugo's closest friends during the years he lived in Eagle Pass were a well-known Piedras Negras attorney, Vicente La Fuente Guareca, and his wife, Elonia. The Guarecas were godparents to Lugo's youngest daughter. 5 years ago, Vicente was gunned down on a Coahuila highway. Mexican police investigated the incident as a killing possibly related to drug trafficking. Lugo is now 62 years old. In 2005, when I was a reporter for the San Antonio Express News, he contacted me, asking for an opportunity to tell his side of the tangled story. We spoke on the telephone a few times, and I read a great deal about the case. Looking at the facts, it was not hard to wonder if Lugo might have had something to do with Gomez's death. But why? And if he was guilty, why had the FBI investigation and the Del Rio grand jury failed to bring him to trial? One day I went to see Lugo at his beige brick McAllen home in the hopes that a visit might help me understand what had happened that night. Lugo answered the door, dressed only in dark blue shorts, his gray hair combed perfectly. He welcomed me into a suburban-style living room with a large television, a prominent photo of a group of soldiers in Vietnam, and a glass frame full of medals and ribbons. His wife, bedridden since 2004 after a stroke, was in a back room. As we talked, Lugo lounged on a sofa. I quickly realized what investigators meant about his being hard to follow. His thoughts seemed to bounce in every direction. Sometimes he closed his eyes and scanned the inside of his skull while he spoke. One minute, he was telling me about how his partner's death had helped him discover who he really was. The next minute, he was rambling on about the definition of truth, according to Sherlock Holmes. All of a sudden, he scampered away like a barefoot child looking for a toy, returning moments later with a tray of pills for sleep, diabetes, depression, anxiety, and his heart. "This is my life," he said. His light brown skin was highlighted by the dark mail carrier tan line around his neck. His bare chest was marked by a 6-inch vertical scar from a heart surgery. "I don't want to make my life complicated," he told me. "I've managed to survive." He showed me a laundry basket size archive of deposition transcripts, sworn statements, and court petitions, and a briefcase full of old government memos written by agents and supervisors. It was all very neatly organized. A cardboard box cradled his 156-page manuscript. A red folder was titled "The Manipulation of the Media." A green folder had a large sticker on it with these typewritten words: "Our generation of Hispanics went through hard times just to merit our piece of a dream. My life has not been easy, but without divine help, I would not have made it this far. The exoneration is a legacy destined to be billed as the greatest corrido ever written. The story just happened. All I did was tell it in words." Lugo clings to his small archive as if it holds a key to the old case that has somehow been overlooked or ignored. But the bitter reality is that unless someone else comes forward, he will always have to live under the burden of being the only person with a story to tell about what happened on the night in question. Death and the Matrons. With her trial soon to begin, everyone wants to know how Rowlett's Darlie Routier could have brutally stabbed her kids. As the case of another accused murderer suggests, the answer lies in the suburbs. By Jim Atkinson, published October 1996. The most infamous residence in all of Texas suburbia sits in a small development of two-story tract homes just off Texas Highway 66 in the sleepy East Daly County town of Rowlett. The front yard is small, a strip of grass, really no more than half the size of a typical suburban yard. The red brick home that lords over it brings to mind the main office restaurant of some place called the Colonial Motor Court on some lonely highway in West Texas. For years, the only notable thing about it was the small stone fountain that stands just to the right of the front door, the sort of anomalous, if not vulgar, touch that turns heads in the burbs. But on June 6th, the house became notorious for what allegedly happened inside. Sometime after midnight, the Rowlett police assert, 26-year-old Darlie Routier viciously stabbed to death her two eldest sons, 6-year-old Devin and 5-year-old Damon, while they lay asleep in front of the television set, then turned the knife on herself and inflicted several alibi wounds to her neck, arms, and hands. Then, according to her arrest warrant, Darlie told both her husband, who had been asleep upstairs with their third child, 8-month-year-old Drake, and the police an extravagant lie about awakening on the couch in the family room to find her two sons stabbed to death and an intruder standing over her, bloody knife in hand. "She struggled with the intruder," she said, "and eventually chased him off through a window in the garage. Then she dialed 911. When news of the child murders in the suburbs hit the front pages, most people thought of South Carolina housewife Susan Smith and her much-publicized 1994 drowning of her two children. But when I saw the first photos of Darlie Routier, my mind turned almost immediately to another Texas housewife, Candy Montgomery, who, 16 years before, almost to the day, had shocked the serene Collin County suburb of Wiley by mutilating her friend Betty Gore with an axe in the utility room of Gore's home. There was something in Darlie's and Candy's eyes that was eerily similar, the vaguely haunted look of women who had always longed to be more beautiful. In fact, had always longed, period. Perhaps I made the connection so quickly because I spent 2 years researching and co-authoring with writer John Bloom a book on the Montgomery case, Evidence of Love, A True Story of Passion and Death in the Suburbs. But the more I stared at Darlie's pictures, watched her during her appearances in court, and read of her life, the more the comparison seemed chillingly apt. Darlie Rowdier remains innocent until proven guilty. Indeed, her husband and family have vociferously insisted she didn't do it. But as the Montgomery case taught me, the heinous crime she is accused of is not nearly as unthinkable as we'd like to believe, and the suburban setting in which the violence erupted is not nearly as serene as it may appear. The two crimes differ, of course, in that Candy Montgomery's attack on Betty Gore was prompted by an argument between the two women over an affair Candy had carried on with Betty's husband, Alan, a far cry from the filicide Darlie Rowdier stands accused of. But if the Rowlett police are right, the two abhorrent acts will share the distinction of having been committed by the most normal of women in the unlikeliest of settings. Neither woman had what is known as a psychiatric past, and so the crimes defy any explanation other than a time-honored cliché. I guess I just snapped. Candy admitted as much during her trial by successfully pleading self-defense. She contended that Betty came at her with the axe first, and explaining away the 40-blow overkill as something called a dissociative reaction, which is shrink speak for just snapping. The jury bought it and acquitted her of murder charges. Moreover, the women seem to have followed similar paths to their unseemly notoriety. Candy was 30, not much older than Darlie, when she suddenly found herself in the Collin County Jail on murder charges and the object of public curiosity and ridicule. Both were from the particular sort of itinerant middle-class background that became common after World War II. Candy was a military brat. Darlie was the daughter of an Altoona, Pennsylvania railroad worker and the stepdaughter of a truck driver who moved the family to Lubbock when she was in high school. Both were somewhat plain, but worked hard at adding pizzazz to their appearances. Candy with her ever-changing hair, Darlie with her flashy apparel and baubles. Beyond the superficial, the two women shared a kind of retro version of womanhood that ran counter to their times. Like Candy, Darlie has been described as exceedingly bright, quick-witted, and charming. But also like Candy, she never attended college. Both were courted by ambitious young men pursuing careers in the computer electronics industry in North Texas. Both married soon after high school and got pregnant almost immediately, leaving time for only the slightest flirtation with a career. They seemed preoccupied with being known as supermoms of the sort adored by all the neighborhood kids. Indeed, Candy always seemed much more concerned with being a great mother than being a good wife. And both were obsessed with perfecting every detail in their first suburban homes. When Candy's husband Pat finally hit it big as a computer engineer with Texas Instruments, she threw herself into designing, building, and decorating a new house in the Collin County community of Fairview. Likewise, when Darlie and her husband Darren succeeded at building their computer services firm in the early 90s, they purchased the red brick 3,000-square-foot colonial for $128,000. A lot of house, as they say, for a couple in their 20s. And both women couldn't wait to personalize their dream homes. Candy with ultra-modern styling inside and out, Darlie with her fountain. The particular sort of setting Candy and Darlie chose is known to urban topographers as an exurb. Rowlett and Fairview aren't merely bedroom communities. These havens for the latest wave of white flight are not so much residential extensions of the big city as they are small towns unto themselves. As such, They tend to be geographically and culturally far-flung. All I ever wanted was a house in the country and lots of kids. Kids and animals, Candy frequently said. And indeed, it seemed to me that all her aspirations and dreams, disappointments and depressions, and perhaps her incomprehensible eruption of violence, could be traced to her carefully chosen lifestyle. The simple bucolic life that both Candy and Darley sought could be found here, along with cheaper real estate, lower taxes, safer streets, and better schools. But so could a sense of isolation and boredom that is even more intense than that suffered by residents of the original bedroom communities, let alone denizens of the city. In Candy's case, the satisfaction of her life's longing soon became a source of irritation. She felt stuck, she often said, as if she was missing something. This sense of disconnection, I always felt, had to be especially profound for a woman of her generation. Having given herself over to this sort of retro woman role, she found herself a frustrated spectator to the other, more exciting versions of womanhood being lived out around her. Lifestyles that included a family, a career, and extramarital sex. Or so she fantasized. Not surprisingly, she decided on the latter as an antidote for her malaise. She toyed with the idea of getting her college degree, even took a few courses. But mainly, she flirted with her fellow churchgoer, Alan Gore. She told me that she was looking for an affair that would provide fireworks. But the ensuing tryst turned out to be little more than a few months of moderately passionate nooners, followed by a more platonic friendship that eventually fell dormant for lack of mutual interest. Another version of being stuck. Is it possible that the malaise caused by feeling trapped in suburbia is psychologically similar to the criminal pathology found in the urban underclass, where the sense of being stuck has been blamed for everything from juvenile crime to domestic abuse to the drug plague? It is hard to imagine two cultures that are more different, but the pressures of each day may be enough to cause an otherwise sane person to snap. The idea of suburban angst may seem absurd, given the idyllic facade of suburban life, but maybe that's the point. For some suburbanites, it is nothing more than a facade beneath which their dark or different selves toss and turn restlessly. One of Candy's selves was the happy homemaker living out her Norman Rockwell dream. Another self, one that perpetually longed for something to enliven its existence, dreamed of dabbling in self-destructive, adulterous flings. Darley Rowdier's sunny suburban wife and mother self, it turns out, was joined by another self that penned thoughts of suicide in a diary, and yet another that was judged by some to be an overly flamboyant dresser and a spendthrift. As an anonymous acquaintance of Darley's said after her arrest, there were two of her, kinda. She was a real nice mother who was the June Cleaver type. And then there was the part that made her want to be on Knott's Landing. But alienation, ennui, and acting out are only part of the suburban angst. There was also a certain narcissism about these two women, a kind of hubris that seemed to make them feel somehow above the law. If Candy was contemptuous of her chosen lifestyle, for example, she could also be defensively deceptive about it. After the mutilated remains of Betty Gore were found by neighbors, she did not volunteer to her husband, her friends, or the police the fact that she had an affair with Alan Gore. And even a year after her trial and acquittal, she betrayed little remorse about what had happened. Instead, she whined about how humiliating the pre-booking strip search had been and mugged scornfully for the news media's cameras. The whole business seemed to be out of sight, out of mind, unthinkable. Precisely the suburban worldview. Darley Rowdier may yet be found a victim rather than the perpetrator in the deaths of her sons, but police officers' suspicions were aroused by the contradictory series of statements she gave the morning after her breathless 911 call. Statements that seemed so arrogantly specious that investigators considered them prima facie evidence of guilt. Among the more dramatic of them, as detailed in her expansively documented arrest warrant, was the fact that though she had said her boys were dying, apparently she did not lift a finger to save them as they bled to death, and she never showed any concern about her husband or infant son. Moreover, though Darley implied that the assailant had exited through a slashed screen window in the garage, the police found no trail of blood in the area and no disturbance of dust on the windowsill or mulch in the yard immediately outside the window. Initial tests, in fact, revealed traces of the screen on a knife found in the Rodier kitchen. Finally, the police doubted Darley's own wounds. The neck wound didn't seem to jibe with her account of a vicious assault. It looked self-inflicted, and the wounds on one of her hands were less consistent with her being stabbed than with her stabbing herself. When Darley went to court for pretrial proceedings, she wore an expression of contempt on her face that reminded me of Candy's, as police officers testified about the gaping inconsistencies in her story. She shook her head defiantly. One may choose to view her behavior as normal for a wrongly accused defendant under considerable duress. On the other hand, it may be seen as a slightly different permutation of Candy Montgomery's suburban arrogance, as in, "How dare you question and judge me?" Suburban culture is, above all else, a matriarchy. Its queens are part of the most sought-after political and socioeconomic class of our age. They're the voters politicians are trying to demystify, the buyers marketers are trying to lure. If they feel isolated in their fiefdoms, they also feel morally and socially superior. And if Candy's attitude was any indication, they don't appreciate having their ethical purity questioned. But if Candy Montgomery and Darley Rowdier were haughty, they were also, deep down, unremittingly sad. And no wonder. The suburban dream they had invested so heavily in hadn't paid them back in kind. They had dwindling options. The sheer sanity of their lives had become overbearing. Any of us who take pride in being normal can identify with that predicament, which is why we're so fascinated by cases like these. Hideous crimes always invite our fascination, but only a few elicit an uncomfortable empathy as well. As unthinkable as the crime may be, the alleged perpetrator is not so easily dismissed. She is, as advertised, a totem of all that's supposed to be good and righteous about the American middle class. She is one of us, and when one of us does the unthinkable, it becomes just a little too thinkable for comfort. As a postscript, here is the Wikipedia entry on Darley Rowdier. Trial. The prosecution suggested that Rowdier murdered her sons because of the family's financial difficulties. Prosecutors described her as a pampered, materialistic woman with substantial debt, plummeting credit ratings, and little money in the bank, who feared that her lavish lifestyle was about to end. Crime scene consultant James Crone testified that evidence suggested the scene inside the Rowdier residence had been staged. The prosecution also suggested there was a financial motive for the murders, since both boys had a life insurance policy on them. The defense contended that this amounted to only $10,000, not enough to cover their funeral expenses. Further, they asked as to why, if she was willing to murder for money, that she did not kill her husband instead, who had an $800,000 life insurance policy. The defense also questioned why, if she killed her sons to preserve her lavish lifestyle, she left her youngest son, 7-month-old Drake, alive and unharmed. Rowdier was represented at trial by lawyer Douglas Mulder. Defense attorneys said that there was no reason why she would have killed her children and that the case did not have a motive, a confession, or any witnesses. They asserted that it was unrealistic to accuse Rowdier of staging a crime scene. Her attorneys advised her not to appear on the witness stand, but she testified anyway and withered under cross-examination by prosecutor Toby Shook. San Antonio Chief Medical Examiner Vincent DiMaio testified that the wound to Routier's neck came within 2 millimeters of her carotid artery and that it was not consistent with the self-inflicted wounds he had seen in the past. That differed from the assertions of her treating physicians, who had told police officials that the wounds might have been self-inflicted. Tom Bevel testified that cast-off blood found on the back of Rodier's nightshirt indicated that she had raised the knife over her head as she withdrew it from each boy to stab again. One crucial aspect of the defense case was the bloody sock found outside the house. While the police contended that this was merely a ruse designed to falsely implicate an intruder had fled the scene, the defense contended that it proved Routier could not have committed the crime. Damon was alive when the paramedics arrived on the scene, and the medical examiner testified that the boy could only have survived approximately 8 minutes after receiving his injuries. Routier was on the phone with 911 for almost 6 minutes. The defense argued that this did not leave enough time for Routier to cut herself, stage the crime scene, plant the sock outside the house, and then return before the paramedics arrived. They also stated that, despite her injuries, Routier's blood was not found in the garage or anywhere outside the home. The prosecution countered that Routier could have planted the sock before self-inflicting her own injuries, and the ME's stated survival time for Damon after he was stabbed was only an estimation. Routier was convicted of murdering Damon. On February 4th, 1997, she was sentenced to death by lethal injection. Post-trial claims and appeals. Defense attorneys allege numerous errors were made during Routier's trial and in the official transcript of it, as well as the investigation of the murders, especially at the crime scene. An appeals court dismissed these claims, as did a court ruling on her habeas corpus petition. In June 2008, Routier was granted the right to new DNA tests. Her appeals were remanded to the state level for improved DNA testing. On January 29, 2014, Chief Judge of the Western District, Fred Byrie, granted a request from prosecution and defense for her case for further DNA tests, vital to the defense to be performed on a bloody fingerprint found in the house, a bloody sock, and her nightshirt. In 2018, the Criminal District Court No. 3 ordered a third round of DNA testing with the backing of both prosecution and defense. Divorce. In June 2011, Darren Routier filed for divorce from his wife, saying that the decision was mutual and very difficult, and that he still believes his wife is innocent. He said that they decided to divorce to end the limbo that they had been in since her arrest and conviction.
That's all the time we have for this edition of Texas Monthly Archives. We invite you next week to once again hear recording library volunteers and staff read articles from the files of the National.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 43 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 30s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 40s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 30s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 8 p.m.
Your dial is set for fun. Just lives in your solitude. Your favorite bands are on the stands, and Mr. Miller puts you in the mood. It's make-believe ballroom time, the hour of sweet romance. Here's your make-believe ballroom. Come on, children, let's dance, let's dance.
Hi, folks, I'm Jeff Bressler, turning on lights of the make-believe ballroom and welcoming you into my crystal studio for another program of the great hits of the 1930s and 1940s. I'm hosting the show to keep the music and traditions of past hosts, Martin Block, Al Jarvis, William B. Williams, and the legendary Steve Allen alive. Whether you're one of my longtime listeners or a new listener on public broadcasting or community radio stations across the U.S., as well as in the U.K., go grab your dance ticket, it's free, and let's reminisce. Hello world, and from coast to coast on public and community radio stations, welcome, welcome, welcome to this week's edition of the Make Believe Ballroom, and thanks for joining me this hour as I share some wonderful swing, jazz, and big band records with you. Hope you're all doing well. A few weeks back on the Make Believe Ballroom, I played the first time ever recording of Georgia on My Mind, and no, it wasn't Ray Charles who recorded it, but composer and singer Hoagie Carmichael, who first introduced the record on Victor way back in 1930. So Al Aubrey, a listener out of Northern California who frequently emails me about this and that, Al let me know how much he enjoyed the recording, and he asked for more. So, Al Aubrey, put your plate out, because seconds are on the way, and for you, Al, I will devote this show to first-time recordings of popular songs. I've Got My Love to Keep Me Warm was written in 1937 by Irving Berlin, and it was introduced in the film On the Avenue, where it was sung by Dick Powell and Alice Faye. In 1946, Les Brown and his band released an instrumental version that went on to become a million seller and a Billboard Top 10. The Mills Brothers had a popular version, as well as Red Norvo, Rosemary Clooney, Doris Day, on and on, all the way to Bette Midler and Rod Stewart. But its origins is in this recording, the first time ever recording of I've Got My Love to Keep Me Warm, Ray Noble and his orchestra, with the vocal by Howard Barry, recorded on Victor, January the 5th, 1937.
I need no overcoat, I'm burning with love, My heart's on fire, the flame grows higher, so I will weather the storm. What do I care how much it may storm? I've got my love to keep me warm.
I'm Jeff Bressler. You're listening to the Make Believe Ballroom as I play first time ever recordings of popular songs. Another singer who had a popular version of the just played I've Got My Love to Keep Me Warm came out of Steubenville, Ohio. You know who I'm talking about, Dean Martin. And what song is most synonymous with Dean's career? Well, I'm not talking about Amore. But how about Everybody Loves Somebody Sometime? And it's an interesting story of how Dean recorded the song. Although it was written almost 20 years earlier, by 1964, the song had already been recorded by several artists, including Frank Sinatra, all without much success. Well, Ken Lane, who wrote the song and was the longtime piano player for Dean Martin, was working with Dean on his Dream with Dean LP session, and they had about an hour or so of studio time left, and they were one song short. So Ken suggested that Martin take a run at his tune. Dean was agreeable, and the small combo of piano, guitar, drums, and bass performed a relatively quiet, laid-back version of Everybody Loves Somebody Sometime, which Martin had sung in the past, actually, on radio, on both his Martin and Lewis program, as well as on Bob Hope's radio show. So Dean went on through his career singing Everybody Loves Somebody Sometime virtually thousands of times, but it was actually vocalist Peggy Lee who first sang and recorded the song. Peggy Lee on Decca with David Barber and the orchestra, Everybody Loves Somebody Sometime, recorded November the 20th, 1947.
Everybody loves somebody sometime. Everybody falls in love somehow. Something in your kiss just told me my sometime is now. Everybody finds somebody someplace. There's no telling where love may appear. Something in my heart keeps saying my someplace is here. If I power, I'd arrange for every boy to have your charms. Then every minute, every hour, every girl would find what I found in your arms. Everybody loves somebody sometime. And although my dream was overdue, your love made it well.